Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hey there, Beverly Hills 90210 fam.
You know how when they yell cut, they wouldn't stop.
That's interesting.
What?
Yeah. If you were Donna, what would you have said?
A waitress rather call the police. And she was mistaken 90210 for
Hobson.
Along with your host, Charles Rosen.
But look at that. Dean Cake, and Dan probably got the best performance he ever gave.
We're having a meeting here?
Oh, at least there's one person on this fricata set that knows what they're doing.
Larry Mullen.
I had a friend named Craig Richland. There was still cocaine around and stuff. I always remembered him, and I just kind of thought I would honor my coke dealer.
Get out of here!
Pete Ferrero.
Here's what I learned. It's possible Claire would have gone out with me.
That was your takeaway.
So sit back and relax, because it's like totally time for the Beverly Hills 90210 show.
Just hold on to me tonight.
Hey, here we are back on the Beverly Hills 90210 show. This is a special episode. We're recording it on Thursday. Today's Thursday.
We are recording it on Thursday, October 3rd.
October 4th, which is the premiere day of Beverly Hills 90210. Now, we've always tried to do something for premiere day. The super show we did was on October 4th.
Four years ago.
I believe the 30th anniversary of the show at that time.
That's right. And we're 34 right now.
So we have to do another super show next year. For the 35th.
Let's... All right. Well, that can be. First of all, it is the 3rd. But for those, I'm going to just wish everybody who, even though it's a day, it'll be only the second day of Rosh Hashanah, a happy Jewish New Year to those who observe. I had a real nice morning there at the big sanctuary and then with our little grandkids. So it was a good way to spend the morning and getting prepared for this show. And it certainly brought my mind back to Rosh Hashanah of 1990, which I think is a place to start, because that was September 20th. And we were in the getting close to our premiere date, October 4th. And we were a television show that, although we were making our production schedules by hook or by crook, we were kind of a troubled, not a TV show at that point. I mean, in the extreme. And I had asked the writing staff to, if you're going to, go to Temple and have a lunch and everything, please do that. But let's get together at 3 o'clock that afternoon, because we really have to work on this troubled script we had called Higher Education Number 5. And it was not going to happen. And I got reprimanded for not being, observing the holiday, even though only Darren and I went to separate shuls that day.
Right. Chuck, when you're talking about this episode, are we talking about the pilot? Or are we talking about Green Room?
No, we are talking about the pilot episode.
That's what I thought. I just want to be clear.
That was made, let's be clear, it was produced by Aaron Spelling and E. Duke Vincent. The writer was Darren Starr, and the director was Tim Hunter.
Right.
Who had made a very dark movie that was praised at the time. The River's Edge, I think it was.
Oh, yeah. Called. What a great film. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the lead of it, of course, was the famous actor, young actor who died in a
River club. Phoenix.
River Phoenix. Yeah.
Was Keanu Reeves in that as well? I feel like maybe, or am I making that?
Keanu Reeves comes to my mind with Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. Maybe he was in that. Bill and Ted's kind of factors into the 90210 story too, but not quite yet. That's okay. Actually a next month's story. But in this time, and it's an interesting thing because it was, as we've spoken about it, you know, the pilot was ordered by Fox in their upfronts and in New York, and with a lot of fanfare because it was going to be on the same night as the Fox's lone real breakout hit, The Simpsons. They did have Married with Children,
right? Which is what I always knew Fox from at that time,
and that was, you know, the one show that they had that kind of landed. But in terms of television viewership yet and the numbers, remember, television, especially in those years, was a real numbers game. And they also had premiered In Living Color, which they were forced to premiere because it had come out of another contractual obligation. And they had to put it on, even though the head of the network did not like it. But The Simpsons was the breakout. The Simpsons had come on that spring and you know, getting an order out of the Tracy Ullman show, and everybody was really, really happy about it. And they expected to have this be a monster show. And remember, Fox was new to this, so I don't completely blame them for this. But I did read an article, and I printed out. That's why I put myself as the TV archive.
I love this today. Yeah.
Because I really did, guys. I printed all these papers, and you'll be hearing some reviews. We'll be going over some ratings. But the first thing that you should know is that in the end of June, right about, you know, they ordered the show. They announced their schedule and ordered their show, you know, the entire schedule, and announced that we would be on the air in early to mid-May. I don't get hired to mid-June because nobody signed up to do the show. And I've often talked about with you that the it was a two-hour version. I couldn't get through it.
Right. I was going to ask you. Yeah.
I watched. I would rather than pick it up where I'd fallen asleep. I finished this once, my last script for Northern Exposure, which turned out to be my last script for Northern Exposure, called The Russian Flu. It's a really my favorite of all the ones that I did. I wrote every single word of it, and I get no credit. But anybody ever wants to go back to the archives, find it. The Russian Flu is a lot. It's a lot of fun. My favorite one by far. And I tell my agent the next day that I pass. I'm going to stick with this and thank them very much for considering it. And then I get called later in that afternoon by my agent to say Mr. Spelling wants to take a meeting so that I could hear his ideas. And I was not going to pass on the opportunity to meet a living legend. And it was with that. I also knew that that point, as I was going into it, that what they were offering me was six times more than I was getting for my work on as a supervising producer on Northern Exposure to get my first chance to run a television show. And what was ironic about this is that I had only, prior to the Northern Exposure experience, which started in February of 1990, I had only been on a staff once, and that was in 1985. Oh, that's not true. I had been on staffs in 1980 and 1981, but I mean, in terms of being a producer, only one time on a short-lived show that lasted 3 weeks, so that I came in on the middle of. So it was not something, I was not that conversant on episodic television. I did not, let alone be the point person to how to make it and deal with all the institutions and Mr. Spelling and the Fox Network. And yes, I did go to therapy to learn how to do all those things because I had never had those types of conversations. But I want to go back to this one thing, Pete, which I think is really interesting, is that Fox up in this upfronts had an incredible amount of success. They had sold $550 million of upfront sales, almost entirely based on the success of The Simpsons. Wow. And they gave an opening date to The Simpsons, and we were going to be on that same timeline, theoretically. And yet, by the point that I got hired at the middle of June, it was already known that The Simpsons could not deliver their first episode until October 4th. That was the first Thursday. And so I stipulated, I couldn't ask for very much. But what I could ask for is that we premiere on October 4th.
That makes sense.
That was the pilot, and that would give me an extra week to October 11th to get the first show that I produced on the air. And that was in Midget. That gave me what theoretically should have been enough time.
Yes.
So that's how the date came about. Of course, it didn't give enough time because I sat down and thought how I wanted to do the television show. And with the newly constructed staff. And we based it on the model of the other show I was involved with, not as a staff writer, but kind of as a permanent freelance there in the beginning. And that was a very successful show in the early 1980s called St. Elsewhere. It was the medical version of Hill Street Blues. And it was some terrific stars came out of that show, including Denzel Washington and Alfre Woodard.
Sure.
And many others. It was really well done, produced by Bruce Paltrow, Gwyneth's father, who had also done The White Shadow.
Got it.
And so what they did was it was a kind of a serialized show, which had episodes for different things going on with the different characters. And you'd kind of break them down and continue them, and some would end.
Sure,
and some,
sure.
Kind of the format we ended up doing, ultimately. But at that point, it was made very clear to us 3 weeks after losing 2.5 weeks in the process that they did not want any kind of serialized show. They only wanted shows that were had a beginning and it started and ended on a single A plot with a B plot, and that was it. That's what they wanted. They wanted other things too, but those were impossible to deliver.
That's interesting.
So we went with the, you know, self-contained episodes, they were called.
But I do love that about season one. There is something refreshing about that, that you don't have
to... Well, it was one of the reasons, going back to that meeting with Aaron Spelling, was one of the reasons that I knew that I could deliver the show that Aaron wanted. Because Aaron came in and he knew that the two-hour pilot was a mess. And what was most messy about it was they were at a party where they, you know, with the hot tub, all that stuff up there. And
our friend from The Sopranos.
Yes. If you want to see you naked, you know where to go. It's not Beverly Hills 90210.
No, it's not.
Sopranos show, you know.
Yeah.
Woke up this morning, got myself a gun. Yeah. Right. That one. Anyway, there was just all these music videos that there was being done because the Spelling Company's partner on it was Propaganda, and Fox wanted them to be there because they were known to do great music videos.
I could see the thought process, but this is the TV show.
And it just backfired, and they were really boring, and it put me to sleep and all those things. So Aaron hated those. He said they're all going away. And Aaron, who was a really smart tactician, I have, as anybody who knows this podcast, I had all sorts of issues with Mr. Spelling.
Sure.
But this one, he looked at all the shows that were there. There was Ferris Bueller being the number one off the board. There was Parker Lewis at Fox. There was the
Breakfast Club,
High School Musical that was, I had a different, Whole High they called it, but it was High School Musical.
Sure.
That was coming out of Disney and ABC. And then there was The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. And we're at the bottom of the barrel. And there's us.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Because Ferris Bueller was a TV show at one point, too.
That's right. It was supposed to be a big hit based on a huge movie. And it didn't happen. At that point, there were very few exceptions when a TV movie was when a movie was great that translated to television. And that big exception, of course, is MASH. But outside of that, there weren't too many including my first TV show, which was called Breaking Away, based on a terrific movie that's set in Indiana about bicycle riding. That was just wonderful. If you guys, I'm sure most of you have never seen it. It was worth a look. Very sweet movie. And we did the TV show and we failed. But sure. Nonetheless, getting back to, the situation with Aaron looked at all the shows, and he had once done a high school show where he had undercover cops, Mod Squad. And they dealt with the issues that kids were going through in that late 1960s. And he wanted to emulate that in the 90s. He wanted to have those episodes that not just, about the kids, but about the parents and the whole gestalt of it. And I knew, and why he was interested in me is because I wrote television movies. That's what I was known as. That's how I made my living in the 80s. It wasn't in series television. It wasn't even in original pilots, because although I wrote many and many were praised in the 80s and came very close to being ordered, they weren't ordered. So right. I wasn't known for that. But my TV movies, I was on a very hot streak and had about 7 in a row. And most of them had to do with kids and women and teen issues or different things that the networks wanted.
So Aaron saw that and was like, I have to have Charles Rosen.
Well, Aaron saw that and knew he had to have somebody because everybody was passing. And at the end
you
of
passed
the day,
too, though. Initially, you were passing.
I passed, and then I passed the second time. Aaron got nervous, and the network got nervous when they because they were hiring. And even though I did my my meeting with Fox with a young man who went on to have an incredible career, Bob Greenblatt, who became the head of Showtime, HBO, produced 6 Feet Under. Was really the creative force behind Fox in a lot of ways. He was a development executive at the time. And I went in to see him and his team, and they were fine with me. They liked me. I was 37 years old, by the way, thinking about that. Aaron, somebody got cold feet somewhere. And there was another writer writer named Bill Blinn. And Bill Blinn had written a lot of episodes of Roots. Bill Blinn wrote Purple Rain with Prince. Mm-hmm. And Bill did a lot of other shows and different things and was very well, was very versatile. And Bill, I was coming off before Northern Exposure, a deal at Disney, and they brought Bill Blinn in to rewrite me. And Bill was a producer and I was only a writer, and we were working with stupid dicks who had producing jobs. And when Bill was honored at the Writers Guild, I made sure that I was there. And I never went to Writers Guild dinners or things, but was there for a couple of reasons. But one was to shake Bill's hand. Because Bill wrote me the night, or actually called me on the phone and says he doesn't know why they just didn't go with my script. It was for Robert Guillaume. It was a vehicle for him.
He said,
I looked at this and the dialogue really holds up when you read it a second time. And I'm like, thank you, Bill. That was a big thing with me as a television writer of movies, is that people would not pick up the subtlety of some of the things I would put in as a writer.
Sure.
Until they would really delve in it, or they would film it and, wow, that scene played. I didn't think it would. Well, thank you guys. I was the writer. I thought it would play. And most writers think that way about this stuff. But fortunately, I got the opportunity to have this some stuff made, and it did happen that way. Anyway, going back to 90210, going back to October 4th, or prior to October 4th, really. But, Aaron puts me into the show, and immediately because we're late, a lot of writers that folks want, were interested in, were not available. Fox gave me a writer that you were just talking about recently, David Sten.
You said
he was posting stuff.
He's posting a lot of things. He really just posting green rooms.
Right, because that was his one credit, and he was the first one to do the writing. And David and I was someone who looked at the pilot like I did and was extremely critical. And I was kind of critical. And Darren, who was the young creator and it had success, his movie.
And he wrote the pilot. I'm sure that he wrote.
Darren did write the pilot. And I know that there was a lot of rewriting going on while the pilot.
Sure.
And pilots are very difficult. You know, I got out my list of here. I'll show you this big, thick book that my wife keeps for us with all the episodes that I produced. And the first one is The Class of Beverly Hills, because it wasn't called Beverly Hills 90210. And the final revised drip was March 17th, 1990.
Wow.
So you know that Darren is writing the whole time, because they had to deliver it in about 3 weeks after that.
Yeah.
In April is when you deliver it for a March date. So they were filming and rewriting. And I do know from Aaron Spelling that he was kept begging Darren to write scenes where Brandon and Brenda were really nice to each other and sweet. And when I read you some of the reviews that came out on October 4th, the only thing that the show was praised for in one of the reviews, the last one I'll read to you, was indeed the tenderness between sister and brother. So again, that was an Aaron Spelling instinct. And it was, and the episode was very dark and everything else. So I come into the show and I don't I don't want to work with Tim Hunter.
No, I can imagine. Well, I may imagine why, but yeah.
Well, he wasn't, you know, we talk about this and among my friends, and I got still am close to many people who, especially thanks for the magic of Facebook, of many people who are went to my high school and are in contact with each other.
Right.
And there were a lot of people. We went to high school in a really great time. And you know, we knew it, and the high school was doing well, and everything about it was well, and it was a great time to grow up in a little insulated city like Beverly Hills.
Sure.
Which only had one high school. There was no West Beverly. That was the fake high school.
Right.
Which was done for legal reasons. We could not call it Beverly Hills High School. And so... I really liked high school. I mean, I was like a Brandon. I was a student body officer. I wanted to bring that to it, and the dances and the names and the fun stuff we did and what was going on in the different departments, et cetera, et cetera. And there was a really, you know, anti-wealth, anti, you know, mocking of it, kind of spoofing it in one sense with having a valet parking and the other things that just, but kind of not so great, you know?
So when you saw that in the pilot, were you like, this is ridiculous? But
yeah.
When I saw it in the pilot, I thought that, I mean, I was in New Jersey. I had no idea what was going on. I thought that might be possible. You know, I mean, I thought it might
be possible. Well, exactly. That's how it got through. But there was nowhere to just do Beverly Hills and just do Rich Kids as Rich Kids, as the way that someone like Steve Sanders was presented.
Right.
Would not work. You know, it just over time. It would work if you were doing a comedy.
Sure.
But we were doing a 1 hour drama. We weren't even doing a dramedy. We just had two little freshman boys running around.
You guys did do some comedy stuff for sure. You know what I mean? But not
moments.
Not initially. Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
I don't know if there's anything funny in the pilot. And
the one time that we did finally say, the network finally said, you know, you got the social drama stuff down. Can't you do something lighter? And we came back with Famous Where You Find It, which was the episode with Laverne.
Yeah. No, that was great.
The new Fox executive, Sandy Grushow, didn't want to air it. Because it wasn't part of what we had established. It was different. And one thing I always loved about television And it made me out of the mainstream of thinking of my era of television was I thought people wanted differences each week when they turned on. That they didn't want it to always be the same thing.
And then you made the point of that, like with the 60s episode, you know what I mean? And some of the things later on, like
some things were heavy, some things were lighter, some things were, what was going to be the tone? The tone of each one would change. Yeah. And I like that. And Aaron Spelling would ultimately went along with that.
Well, you talked about the music videos before. What was that in the pilot? There were just long sequences of like a montage to music. Is that what you're?
Yeah, people dancing at the party and just cutaways and just and like not great songs. It was like no Madonna. They weren't dancing to Madonna. Right.
Just a bulky section of people dancing and nothing interesting happening.
and fast cutting. The kind of Aaron wanted a more traditional show. And that first the series that I mentioned, Breaking Away, had that.
Right.
Beautiful show, but all but cut like a formal older television show. 90210 was not a cutting edge television show. It was started to be when finally the shackles came off and we could do episodes like The Gentle Art of Listening and Isn't It Romantic?
Yeah.
And we could start to do things that you hadn't seen on television in a high school setting before. But that's already down the road. That's not what we'll be talking about today. Episode is about our podcast episode could be called Yes, the Fourth Year, you know, a survivalist guide. How did we get through How did it happen, you know?
But how did Darren react to people saying the pilot's too long? You have to remove the music videos. You know, this was his baby
know. I think he was there for the first time, and so he was listening to the advice of he liked Tim Hunter a lot. He liked the auspices of propaganda and chance to work with Mr. Spelling put him in the major leagues. So he liked that too. I know that fellow David Sten, who did not like the pilot, over a period of about a month, getting to know Darren and everything else what could happen in that relationship, that he changed his mind. And when he turned in the first drafts of his first script, The Green Room, it was closer to the pilot than it was to a new thing that we were looking how to do TV.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Although it did start, if you remember, a vision of Brandon catching a wave and all of that. It was dreaming and we had more fantasy sequences and things like dreams and things like that in the beginning. But with the big thing was that when we came back to the network in about 1 week. I remember they rejected everything we did as a serialized television show or a segmented, I'll call it, television show. Where, for instance, we had one thing that I know would have been cute, and we should have done it in 90210 in high school, which was to have that, if you remember the movie American Graffiti, had Suzanne Summers driving a white T-Bird through town. That was a big thing about it. Well, we had that at Beverly Hills. They would step out of something and see that car with that hot, who is she? And we were going to continue that. Well, can't do anything like that.
Oh.
Because you couldn't have overlap on episodes.
Right.
Not until I'm late.
Yeah.
Not until I'm late could we do that. By the time we could have been able to do that creatively, we were starting our senior year. And our characters.
There's no time for it.
Had moved past that.
Yeah.
They were more connected. They were there. This was there. This was the Walsh town now. This wasn't, they were not no longer fish out of water.
Exactly.
There's a phone call and we've talked about it, but it's important setting up what happened on 10-4 was, and the only reason that we made it to 10-4 is because we broke down, Darren and I and the rest of the cast, we had finally now broken down the first six episodes, the introduction of Dylan McKay, the new character that was in the green room, of course. And I'm presenting it on the phone to the executives at Fox, two executives, at like 7 o'clock at night on July 3rd. And they reject every episode. But I'm fighting like the debater, the skilled debater that truthfully, guys, I used to be, and would not, and we'd get to the end. And the network would say, not kill it, but okay, let's go on. They didn't, like, I would have the last word, and then they would say, let's go on.
What's happening? We're doing it. We're moving on to the next episode, right?
That's exactly right. So I called every writer and said, start writing that night. You're open. Start writing. And they all turned in outlines by, you know, a week to 10 days later. And the network was, we didn't approve these. Had that moment not happened, there were two shows. One is called DEA and one is called Against the Law. And they both were the first two cancellations of the season because they couldn't deliver enough scripts in time.
Right. Yeah.
So that, I think, is the most important thing.
That's very important.
That, yeah, I did for this show and that first part going up. But you got to remember, I wrote some of this stuff down. It was not a happy writing staff. You know, I think we've talked about this. Try to imagine you're doing this show and you're working for the spelling company and you're at a studio. It's called Werner Hollywood. And You've heard that the spelling company is going to be leaving the studio and moving into a grand office building on Wilshire Boulevard. The establishing shot of Melrose Place is that building.
Right.
And I call up the guy who had just moved us into our office at the end of the day. All the writers are gone. And I say, because there's a memo that comes out saying, don't come in tomorrow. We'll be moving you. And I said, I got the memo. Where are we going to be located in the new office building? Long pause on the phone. And the guy says, let me call you back.
Right.
And I'm looking at our then unit production manager, who was a very nice man, older than me, a generation older than me. And he's smoking a cigarette. I had quit smoking for 7 years prior to this. Yeah, so 6 years prior to this. And I leaned out and I said, John, can I bum a cigarette right now? You know, oh, my God. And they had no room for us. And so what we had to do was tell the writers to stay home. And I would call them each period. But there were no Zoom calls.
Right.
There was no way to get in touch with everybody.
Yeah.
And they finally found us a place in the back of the editorial department of where they cut Twin Peaks. Because propaganda had something to do with the production of Twin Peaks.
Got it.
And there were all these guys wearing earrings in 1990. It was pretty hip, very hipster, as hipster as it gets in LA at the time.
Sure.
And, you know, because it was fucking Twin Peaks.
Exactly.
Me.
It's a huge show.
A show that should have gone down in history as one of the great miniseries of all times. But now they're coming back for season two. And the interesting thing is the last episode they wrote that they aired was against our last episode of the season. And we outrated them.
Of course.
By that point. But This is his point. And I remember E. Duke Vincent came there. And this, by the way, it was in their conference room that we held the casting that produced James Eckhouse and Luke Perry. That's some of the stuff that we were doing because it was not a place conducive to do writing.
Well, but wait a minute. In the pilot, James Eckhouse is in the pilot.
Well, that was one of the things that with Barry Diller always liked to change something. So he decided that he wanted a different dad. And
the original dad was the dad from Ferris Bueller's, the original movie, right?
Correct. And given the direction that we were moving with the show that Aaron had agreed to, James was a much better choice.
Oh my God, yeah.
I understand why
they went after someone with a recognizable as a recognizable father from a movie. You know what I mean? I just can't see him as
well.
Jim
it's all
Walsh.
These it's all these like notions that make sense, but when you put it all to some of its parts, it didn't really work.
So that was another thing that didn't work.
The reviews, when we turn it and I start reading a couple of reviews, and portions of them, you'll see that's what everybody came to the conclusion.
So you watched, going back to the pilot initially that you saw,
right?
Did you like the cast? Were you? I mean, outside we just talked about the dad. You knew that probably needed to be swapped out. There's no Dylan in the pilot.
I liked.
Who said there needed to be a Dylan?
I liked Priestley a lot.
Uh-huh.
He was gorgeous. I liked Jenny. I thought Jenny was real cute. She wore bicycle pants at one point, and I thought that was about as fashion forward as I've ever seen anything on TV.
Well, the girl from the Sopranos,
Shannon's, Brenda's care part, which had to do with her pretending she's older than 18 to go out with a law student who to me looked 35 and didn't even look like a law student. Remember, my wife had been a law student. I knew exactly what law students look like, and he didn't look like it. And I just thought that was you'll see some of the criticisms of the show. There was nowhere to go with that.
Right.
I thought the character that they really were going to focus on was the hottie in the hot tub.
Leslie Bega is who we're talking about.
Leslie Bega is the actress.
Yeah.
And I mean, her character was named Mary Ann because she reminded me of the rich girls of Beverly Hills.
This is who we're talking about that's in The Sopranos later on. For those that are. Yeah. And she's so beautiful in this. I mean, you would expect her to be in the series to the end. You know what I mean?
I think she was a little bit of a diva. And I guess there was maybe some money issues. There were things that were beyond my pay grade coming in. They didn't want her back. She wasn't going to be back. So we switched Kelly to be more like her. Yeah,
it works.
And Kelly was sexually active, and I just needed somebody there to be sexually active.
Right.
And I thought what they were doing with Steve, I had confidence that we could make him more, keep him basically the same kind of kid, but make him much more in depth. And I think that you have to wait till the 12th episode we did, Slumber Party, when he and Brendan go out and try to pick up girls and his car gets stolen. I think that's the first episode that's, yes, we can do really a lot with this character.
Sure.
And again, by that time, Darren and I are in a different space and we're doing a different, we're doing it together.
Had Shannon was fine at this time, right? There was no like, this is a great young actress. She's going to be Brenda, the brother. Was there any like rumblings of it? Right.
The only thing I remember is that Shannon did something that, that you're not supposed to do. And that is she changed her hairstyle and didn't tell the company.
This is prior to the pilot.
No, they shot the pilot.
Prior to the green room.
Prior to the green room. And in that period of time, she
probably
took off her bangs, did a lot of different things, changed her hair color a little bit. Spelling Company and Tony Shepard freaked out. And I remember going with her and Tony and sitting there while at a fancy salon in Beverly Hills while they reshaped her hair to be closer to the
it wasn't anything that we would get to. It was just a young actress maybe making a fast decision.
Right. And the template that we got and in the six episodes we did and where we followed up was there's going to be an episode for Brenda. There's going to be an episode for Brandon. It was Brandon, Brenda, Brandon, Brenda, Brandon. And then it was, wait a second, Darren wrote Perfect Mom, which was Kelly Brenda.
Right. Interesting.
And in truth, Shannon did not like that at all.
Right.
And not it was a lot of not great dynamics on the set for that particular episode, which was the second episode that Bethany Rooney directed. And Bethany did first time. So we had two random directors on one and two. Have you ever heard of Melanie Mayron? Do you know who she is?
That sounds familiar. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Melanie Mayron was a one in the ensemble of 30 something, which was my favorite television show at the time. Mm. And she was not, she was this a supporting character, not the lead. And but she was part of the ensemble. And she directed an episode in the season right before ours starting. Maybe its last episode. I can't remember when 30 something actually stopped. But
right.
I loved it. And I asked her to do the second episode. And the first episode that was The Green Room was being shot by a fella named Michael Ono, who I would who I met socially and was starting as a director. So those two people, and was a longtime teacher, professor at SC. He was more maybe suited for that environment. But he did a great job for us. And we've always talked about that The Green Room on the first day, we were behind, and we made our day because Michael Ono knew what to do as we were losing the light at the beach.
Right.
And so points, thank you, Michael. And Melanie couldn't do it, but another one came in. But we did a guy who worked closely with Glenn Caron on Moonlighting, and I worked with these guys on that first Breaking Away show. I brought him in to do two. I brought Bethany to do back to two, and they switched off. And then I forget who did the one, and then we brought him for the eighth episode, Dan Attias.
Yeah.
And he became one of, you know, the lead director.
But but there's no Dylan in the pilot, so who says we need a character like this? Was it Sandy?
No, Sandy was not in that kind of position yet. It was the executive I dealt with who had Sandy's job before Sandy was named Paul Stupin. He became one of the executive producers of Dawson's Creek.
Sure,
I was the first executive producer of Dawson's Creek, at least in the first season that it aired. We weren't buddies when he worked for Fox. We thought we could be buddies when we did Dawson's. That was not going to be the case. Paul is a much better producer than he was a network executive at the time. And let's face it, it was a new network, a lot of pressure,
sure,
a lot of money at stake. And, you know, I've got to go now back to something that we talked about, 40 minutes ago when we was talking about when Fox ordered all this money that they allocated to the Simpsons.
Yes.
And then they were paying them, and they had done that and taken money in, but they had to freeze the money because they could not make good on what they had just taken all this money in. And because that had happened, they couldn't cancel our television show because they didn't have any replacements. The other thing that happened right at this time,
they literally just did not have anything else.
And nothing. And all the money they brought in to become their development fund. And here's the other thing to note. This is not I'm not criticizing Rupert Murdoch for this, but this is just the story.
Sure.
And this story comes from November 1990, mm-hmm. but the impact of that was felt on October 4th, 1990,
sure,
which was that Mr. Murdoch had spent all this money, $600 million to start this satellite in England for all of his programs and around the world, and the British Broadcasting Company wasn't going to let him do it. And they got into litigation, they got into fight, and all of a sudden, the News Corporation is in $8.7 billion worth of debt.
Wow.
Until they could resolve this. They had no money for anything. No money for production, no money for staff, no money for promotion. They were just on the idea of, we got attitude. They had a slogan, but they didn't have much. They did not have the resources.
Right. Well, did you say who said We need a Dylan.
I think it was a combination of I think Aaron and the network and the audience. They wanted a bad boy. I mean, when you hear the reviews, I mean, there was no antagonist. There was nothing. And the antagonist they had was Steve Sanders.
Right.
And was he an antagonist?
No.
Or was he a buffoon? No. He just was a rich kid who was a, you know.
So when they said that to you, you were like, oh, I could totally see that character.
Exactly. And the writing staff came together. I think we've talked about this. We wanted the bad guy to be somewhat like Matt Dillon in The Outsiders, you know, something like that, a leather jacket and a motorcycle. And Jordan Booty, who factors into this time in the first six, was the one who said, no, he should be living by himself in a upscale hotel in Beverly Hills. And we went, oh. And he liked wearing suits, you know, suits and blue jeans. And he had a motorcycle. And I brought in Andy Surfed.
Yeah.
So that was that. I always feel that that's what I brought to the party for the character of Dylan McKay was the ocean.
I just side note that they shot my interview for the Luke documentary at that hotel at the Bellage London.
We did it in the Bellage, and the only reason. I think I've often said this too. The only reason that we got permission to shoot in a thriving hotel like that is that my uncle gave them the money to stay open when they had a construction finance problem. These were two guys that he knew. And because of that, they were really nice to my uncle, the nephew. And they let us.
What do you think? What do you think the day rate for the hotel would have been back in that day? I know how much it was for this thing that we did.
Well, I don't know, but we had no money to pay, so it was a big discount.
What do you think it was for? What do you think it is now? If you had a guess,
tell me it wasn't over $20,000.
No, it was $13,000. I think you said it was $1,300 to shoot in the.
That seems about. I was hoping. I would say we got about $500-$600. Yeah.
Yeah. $1,300.
We would sometimes take over the day, take a room.
Yeah. Oh, it's totally different. We were in one little side little room. Yeah.
The only times we really took over that hotel big time were the prom episodes, not Spring Dance, but the
pool.
The pool, yeah, but no, that was up on the roof at night. And the big one was things to do on a rainy day, because we took the entrance, we poured rain on things, we were running up and down the hotel.
Well, even in the green room, though, you guys use it a bunch.
We always used a room,
Dylan and the group are like walking through the
right. Exactly. Yeah. And so we used it, and it was a terrific location for our needs. And
still great, by the way. I don't know if you've been there.
Yeah, it's the London now. Oh no, I know, it's very fun.
Yeah,
but by October 4th,
yes,
what we're doing as a TV show at that point is we've shot we've redone the pilot. We did the green room. We did Every Dream Has Its Price Tag. We did, we then shot One on One, the basketball episode, my first episode, but that one aired after the first time, which is also what we shot. When October 4th rolls around, we are shooting Higher Education, which is the cheating in school, and Perfect Mom is being prepped. And I remember this specifically because there was a little, you know, Darren turns in his first draft of Perfect Mom.
Right.
And I think it's fabulous. I think the dialogue is great. I think it's right on point. I'm very happy knowing you did first time. But first time, as I look back in that big, thick book that I lifted up in the first part of our podcast here, you know, it was that had a lot of notes. A lot of people did different things. We changed things up here and there and everywhere. Not in Perfect Mom. I really loved it. My colleagues did not. They had lots of notes. They had lots of this. And I found myself not taking any of them and being with Darren. And I thought that would be a sign that we were together now.
Sure.
Darren was still kind of, why are you running the show? Who don't know what you're doing.
And this is my show.
It should be my show. And I know you don't like the pilot. You said terrible things about it. And
that's true.
And so don't give me this bullshit that you like this script.
Oh, I see.
Right, Ive. And that's where we were at that point. And it didn't get any better until we came back from our winter break between he and I. And at that point, whatever we, you know, are we going to save the show or are we not going to save the show? And he had just done Slumber Party. And Slumber Party was a real good, yeah. Everything worked in Slumber Party, in my opinion. And where we were at with the network at this point was they knew that they couldn't cancel us. They tried.
Sure.
They even had Darren write a TV version of Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure to replace us while he's doing this show. So maybe wow. I wasn't thrilled.
I didn't know that.
I wasn't too thrilled with some of the choices he was making.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know? But because I was all in on this show, I didn't have any other, you know, backups.
Would not have done well, by the way, that show.
Well, I don't know about that. It wouldn't have done well as well as Beverly Hills 90210.
Definitely not. Yeah. Well, yeah.
But as we come to this point at 10-4, where we are is we have just changed producers. My friend Jeffrey White had been let go, and Paul Wagner had been coming in, getting ready to do the 17-year itch. That sure. was just about to happen.
So all this stuff is happening. The show is being made as this is about to be debuted.
Right.
So
right.
It's which is so fascinating because you have no idea what the result is going to be.
Correct. Correct.
You're doing all the thing. You're doing the show. It feels good.
In a vacuum of what you think might work, might not work.
You're looking at a daily. Oh, that seemed like a good scene. I don't know. Like, I don't know what anyone even thinks of the pilot yet. Nobody even has a comment. It's all speculative at this point.
Well, we're putting it together, if the scenes work, and we knew that the pilot that we were airing, the 90-minute pilot, was infinitely better than the 2-hour, and much better than the previous hour because 90 minutes because we had James Eckhouse.
Right. Right. Exactly. So there was incremental improvements made on the pilot that people were going to be interested in.
Right. And as
no music videos, you know what I mean? Right.
And the other thing that I'm told coming in around October 4th is Bethany comes back to start doing and prepping Perfect Mom. And she says to me that the episode that she first did the first time had the worst mix on television she had ever heard. And what was I doing on the stage? How could I not improve it? And I went, on the where? I did not know that as an executive producer that I should be there at the layback and be the final option yes. right in there.
Yeah.
And by the gentle art of listening, that was my job.
Got it.
And that was a prime part of my job. For the first 7, I was just treading through water and didn't know. And wouldn't have had the 2.5 hours to give.
No,
you know, this was the period of time where I made the story that I would wake up as a jolt at 6 a.m, knowing that somewhere in the universe there's a meteor, and the meteor is going to land on me directly. And it's going to take me 2 hours
right.
to dig out of the meteor, the rubble of the meteor. And a bad day was when 3 meteors hit all at once. And that happened numerous times in this first period sure. of time. But all this stuff is going on. And so there's no minus. And the reviews come out.
Well, so where were you when the episode, did you watch it? Did you watch the pilot? Did you?
Oh, yeah. Well, we had a fun. First of all, October 4th was my father's, 1990, was my father's 75th birthday. I'm actually wearing the one shirt, the one Madras shirt that he had that ended up in my closet.
Nice.
To honor him as we do this show. And I remember not going to whatever birthday dinner the family was having. And instead, Darren had a very nice little party at his house. And that became a tradition. He did that at the start of the second season. Third season, he was gone. And I didn't do one until the start of the fifth season. We had moved into a bigger house. But we the only time the cast came to my house was to do for the cast reading of The Green Room. And I remember that the woman who was doing the second episode was saying, "This is terrible. You have to change everything." And I was going, "No, I think it's okay. I'm going to keep, you know, it going." Because I had to make the trains run. And remember, the other thing that I hope are those who are sticking with this very long podcast, I know.
That's but okay.
An interesting one, I hope. Was that one of the first things I said to the staff was that, and I had just come from Northern Exposure, where it had to be the best show in the history of television. It had to be this. The standard was here. And that's what the showrunners wanted. And that's what they were going to get, fighting Universal to do it.
Right.
I wasn't in that position. So my position was, let's do a good show. Let's just do a good show.
Exactly.
And if some of them are better than a good show, we'll really, you know, revel in that. And the only thing I never wanted to have happen is please don't embarrass me.
Right.
Or us as a team. Let's not embarrass ourselves.
So, Chuck, what's it like after it airs? Is everyone high-fiving at the party that you're at?
It was fun being at Darren's house, I remember. And
Darren like, "Oh, wow, what a hit. We got a hit on our hands." Or are people like, "You know, this could have been better, that." Like, what is happening in your world?
That's the question. I'm going to do some reading now. And you're going to know the answer.
Okay.
This is from distinguished critic Howard Rosenberg for the Los Angeles Times. Pulitzer Prize winning critic. "You've been sitting on the edge of your seats and holding your breath, waiting for this beauty, right? So here it is, the new Fox drama series that, quote, explores the realities and myths of social classes in Beverly Hills, as opposed to Tarzana. The 90-minute premiere of Beverly Hills 90210 airs tonight on 8:30 on Channel 11. Its regular time slot will be 9 o'clock on Thursdays, giving the feeling you've been watching for 90 days. Here's the scoop. A family from Minneapolis, where the values are good, moves to Beverly Hills, where the values are bad. The opening story is about assimilation, with 16-year-old twins, Brandon and Brenda, Jason Priestley and Shannon Doherty, pitting their great values against the lousy values of their rich, pampered, hedonistic classmates at West Beverly High. Whose values win? Oh, it looks pretty bad for Brandon and Brenda at first, but, well, you can take the kids out of the Midwest, but not the Midwest out of the kids." A zip code for stereotypes and stock characters, Beverly Hills 90210 is nothing if not predictable, with the twins each facing moral choices and ultimately doing the right thing, presumably because they're from Minneapolis. The story really goes over the edge when Brandon, feeling guilty about perpetuating a false rumor that he had sex with one of his fetching female classmates, announces on the school radio station that nothing happened on their hot tubbing date. Meanwhile, West Beverly High and its student body of indulged brats and future Zazas is the kind of school you'd like to hit with a giant cream pie. After a freshman smashes up a fancy car, the school's BMOC cries out, "What did I do to deserve meeting a dork like this?" Exactly your feeling credits roll by.
Nice.
That's from the hometown newspaper.
That's someone in LA wrote this? Someone
Howard Rosenberg, the number one critic in the United States.
Oh, now,
let me read you what Tom Shales, the number two critic in the United States, he wrote for the Washington Post, what he had to say. "Please, no more TV show or movie titles with Beverly Hills or Bel Air in them. If Hollywood producers can't see beyond Southern California, at least they could give Santa Monica or Sherman Oaks or even Pasadena a chance. Ultimately, The title is hardly the worst thing about Beverly Hills 90210, the Fox series premiering, blah, blah, blah. It apparently part of a new experiment in comatose television, a show where things almost happen but never quite do. You keep checking your pulse to make sure you haven't died. Okay, it goes on from there. The last paragraph, I'll jump to the last paragraph, just making fun of Tom Shales was a really good writer. Darren Star wrote this thrill-a-minute shocker. Tim Hunter directed it, and good old Aaron Spelling is one of the executive producers. In a way, what they've done is amazing. They've created a vacuum, a perfect void, a black hole in the already vast and empty TV schedule. Not so much a black hole, actually a beige one.
Where is this from? Who's this now?
Tom Shales, Washington Post.
Oh, shit. Yeah.
Now, the other...
You respect the Washington Post, Chuck, so this must have been shocking when you saw that.
I don't know about the... Howard Rosenberg and Tom Shales were the one and two.
Yeah, exactly.
Number three was a man named David Bean Cooley.
Okay.
He writes for the New York Post, and I think he did for a long time. He was younger than Rosenberg and Shales.
Is that who we have right now?
Coming up. And this one, you'll see it's different than the first two, and you'll see why. First off, the number of the title of Fox News drama series, Beverly Hills 90210, isn't the date. It's the zip code. And it's the only zip code this flashy but empty show has to offer. And it's the only zip this flashy but empty show has to offer. Well, its premise is painfully easy to describe. High school kids move with their parents from a quiet Minnesota to glitzy Beverly Hills, where the fast times at Beverly Hills High School tempt and confuse them. They go on the transplanted siblings, interesting crowd. He charms a rich girl passively by listening to her talk. She sends him roses and has them delivered to his Spanish class. When Brenda learns the ways of movie star makeup on Rodeo Drive wardrobe, she becomes friends with one of the prettiest girls in school and eventually lies about her age to become romantically involved with a much older man. Both are tested in the series pilot, not with a pop quiz or a science exam, but in the ways made for TV morality. Does he allow his peers to spread a false rumor that she continued to deceive her older suitor? In other words, with these Midwestern transplants find a way to keep their values intact, even in California? Of course they will, up to a point. They talk about the plot. A subplot, Brandon discovering the fellow student has lied about her lifestyle and is actually poor by local standards. Does he promise to keep her secret? Of course. He's a good guy. Does he convince her to reveal the true self rather than shallowly conform to the gaudy status quo? Of course not. He's not that good. In the series, with wavering moral code and ultra-rich atmosphere, comes dangerously close to glamorizing the very things they intended to denounce. Doing for snotty, loaded, and financially and chemically kids what Miami Vice did for drug dealers. And even if it's rooted in reality, that's a flimsy excuse. Now, this is where this one really got me.
Okay.
Executive producer Charles Rosen.
Your name is going to be.
Who's an actual alumnus of Beverly Hills High School, may know his subject well, perhaps even too well. But his series plot here is remedial, even by Fox's standards. The leading characters succumb too easily to the fast track and redeem themselves almost as quickly. Where's this series going? And who's going to want to go with it? Now, we haven't even started yet on me. Rosen may have a good recent credit as supervising producer of CBS's Northern Exposure, but a more telling credit is that he wrote the script for ABC's recent, thoroughly horrid Beach Boy docudrama. Fox lucky streak has gone from hot to cold, and Beverly Hills is another stupid stumble. Look for BH 90210 to be canceled by 10291.
Oh, wow. That's great. Great writing, by the way. Lovely writing. Okay.
What, Bean Cooley? All of them.
10-2.
I actually wrote Bean Cooley a letter.
Good.
And said, I had nothing to do with the fucking pilot. At ABC, I was the writer, and the ABC story on Beverly Hills, on the Beach Boy movie, was one of the best scripts I ever wrote, but they didn't tell me that that it was going to be a half hour too long. And right. So this incredible opening of following Dennis Wilson, the cute drummer,
yes.
for 15 minutes as before he dies, the last 15 minutes of his life, gone, had to just kick it off the top. So, okay, guy, so you don't know that. You're coming after me, you know.
Well, it's shocking that he came after you specifically and not more Darren or Aaron. Darren or Aaron, you would expect.
Aaron, you would have expected.
Yes.
That's right. But I do want to point out one thing, because here's the one. So my wife didn't, you know, who kept a great scrapbook for us, didn't cut that one out. But she cut this one out. Beverly, not totally cool in high school. And it's a TV preview by Matt Rausch, who worked for USA Today, a more broad mainstream, but a really big entertainment department in those first years it was there. And outrageous intense, he says. That was a word that Darren used both a lot right. in the script. And he talks about that. But babes are outrageous. And wow, you are intense. Or socially, things are really intense. And he, you know, using that over and over again. But beyond the stock characters, the freshman dweebs, the rich dweeb with a new nose job, that's Kelly, the peripheral parents, the mousy scribe, there's a sweet sister-brother bond here on par with better John Hughes youth pandering flicks. Hi, Aaron Spelling. And it goes more. And it said the last two paragraphs, at best, there's a sense that the trendiness merely masked the goodness of motivation of motivated kids trapped in gilded cages of peer pressure and led astray by unlimited allowances and unsupervised adolescent urges. Not all that contemptuous, though exceedingly obvious. Few will leave cheers for this when it moves to 9 o'clock next week, but it's one of Fox's few moderately promising newcomers.
Interesting.
So, yeah. That was the interesting, and Matt Rausch remained a friend of the show. He moved to TV Guide, and I'm just curious though,
going back to my question about what was everyone's reaction at the party when you watched it.
Well, come on, everywhere you've heard this again. No one expected it to get through 12.
So you were like, okay, we got Green Room coming. You had to probably be thinking in your mind, next week we got Green Room. This one's a little bit better. You knew the touches of what you had been working on over the course of whatever it was going to be a bit better. You had Dylan.
We delivered two episodes back to back. We delivered one-on-one and the first time. Mm-hmm. And Fox had their weekly meeting. And Barry Diller's response to those two, he said, yeah, it's a good show and it's coming together.
Right.
But does it belong on our air? Is it? Because Diller was the first person in television, excuse me, to think of things branded.
Sure.
Branding. And he wanted to be, you know, youthful and edgy in this. And here we're doing a,
yeah,
kind of a sweet show with the thing in this, and it's work. And he knew it was working, and they didn't have anything to replace it with. And so what had happened by that point is we get to the changing of our producers. And I remember Dan McDermott, who was the current exec, came. We were filming at UCLA on a Saturday. We used to film on Saturdays. And he came to UCLA on a Saturday, and we were sitting out on the lawn. It was that twin story thing from of the 17 Year Itch is being filmed.
Sure.
Jeff White's last episode, Paul Wagner's first episode. And he basically says, look, and what basically happened between the episode 8, which was, you know, the gentle art of listening, to the Palm Springs weekend.
Yeah.
They left us alone, except Sandy getting his nose out of joint, having to do with Fame Is Where You Find It. We were left alone. Dan McDermott and I, nobody else at Fox, they had given up on the show.
It was done. As soon as they found something else, it was going to be replaced.
It was going to replace it. Yeah. They had already canceled the two dramas that couldn't deliver.
Right.
And, you know, and here's
That's actually very, I want the audience to really understand the significance of you making sure that you had scripts written for the series. Because if that did not happen, 90210 would have been a victim of Herman's head, whatever things that they just dropped quickly.
Well, yes, you're right about that. And it was largely because of the edict that we had doing Northern Exposure.
Yeah.
Which I got from my friends, Josh Brand and John Falsey, who I'd also done Amazing Stories with and St. Elsewhere with. And we all went back to The White Shadow. That was my first credit. It was most of their first credits. The point being is that production is hard. Don't make scripts your problem.
Right.
And the only time that we ever went into an episode to prep it, even no matter what the number was, when we were doing 32, the only time we did not have a script ready was East Side Story.
Right.
Because I rejected what David Sten had done, and he took his option and resigned from the show before I could fire him. And that was because Darren had done three episodes. I had done three episodes. We'd been writing like crazy. He had done one. And all he had done is complain. All he had done. And now it was time to step up and write your episode.
Right.
And it was not. It was the tone of the green room, not the tone of the same episode that had done all of the ones that we had done. One Boy and a Baby.
Yes. Slumber Party.
Slumber Party. Yeah. It just didn't have the tone. It didn't have the pop. It didn't have the heart.
Yeah.
And truthfully, but I also wanted to go through where our ratings were.
Yeah. Okay.
Because I think that's an interesting thing.
What did the show do? I remember watching it, by the way. I watched the premiere. I loved
it. Well, thank you. The premiere on week one, we did pretty well. We had 10 million viewers and
that's amazing.
we were not in the bottom five. The Simpsons, we were following the Simpsons and the Simpsons had 33 million viewers.
Wow. Well, it had already had an established audience, The Simpsons.
Yeah, and there was a lot of heat on it. The Simpsons, right. The greatest television show ever made. Okay, that's what it is. This is when it was starting. Babes was about three fat girls, and it was a sitcom. I'm sorry to use that term.
No, I understand what you mean, though. Right.
That's what it was. Three very heavy set girls.
Yes.
And who were in their 20s, I don't know, dating, a little older. They got a 17. We got a 10. The series that couldn't get their scripts in on time were in the bottom five. That's now the next week. We're now on Thursday night, and we're up against the Cosby. The Cosby Show is what The Simpsons is up against, and we're up against Cheers. Mm-hmm. So everything changes, and The Simpsons goes down to 29, the green room, the green room is now, and it goes down to 7-8 from 10. Everybody falls. Everybody's falling about 4 million, but we only fall 3 million, and that would be like a win at that point.
Right.
Yeah, we're not as bad as the other shows, and yet it gets worse. And even the next week, with every dream has its price tag, we kind of hold up. Simpsons loses 2 million. The Babes loses 2 million. We only lose 200,000. That's much better.
No, yeah.
And we're doing fine, it seems. But by the time we're now into a little more shows like Higher Education and Perfect Mom, the ones that we were talking about, which were happening, one was being filmed and one was being prepped as we hit this December 4th premiere date. Higher Education had fallen to a 7-6 had fallen to 5-9 and it was in the bottom five. We next week at number 90, the next week we came in number 92 and the next week we came in number 90 again. And we were down to about 6 million viewers from the 10 million.
Crazy.
And when you do that, when you have a downhill slide in the network era, you are done. But they had nothing to replace it. They said they would leave us alone. And what we came out with was the episodes I say. Now, I know that when we finished The Gentle Art of Listening, and it was a fractious staff, I'm giving short shift to that. That was, we all watched it in Spelling's office, the director, the cut that we were going to be delivering. And Aaron loved it. Even David Sten said, that's our first really good episode.
Great.
We follow with, Isn't It Romantic? Always need to say this, especially Darren, you don't return my calls anymore. So I can say this. You wouldn't read Isn't It Romantic because Karen had written it and you were right. So pissed off at me hiring my wife, who you thought had no business to be there. And clearly one of the really great scripts of all time in that show was Isn't It Romantic?
Still, of all the seasons, it's still one of the greatest scripts, if not the greatest, because it's the whole reason we started watching the show as an audience. It was that heat.
Yeah. I always felt that. And also, it was the episode where Brenda and Dylan become a couple.
That's what I'm saying. Like that that started the whole thing.
Right.
The whole
David Sten's response to that, by the way, and you can have either of these guys on any time to refute if they ever
I would be interested. Yeah, but not about that.
The fact is that his response when we started to pitch this was, there's no way that Dylan McKay would go out with someone like Brenda Walsh.
That's why.
If you remember the first shot coming in with the motorcycle, and he looks up at her and her body with the short shorts and the nice top and tight fitting top. What are you talking about?
Exactly. And then,
so you want to know what October 4th was? It was just.
The thing about why it works too is because a lot of the audience can see themselves in Brenda, that she wasn't, you know, she wasn't Kelly in the sense that like she was snooty and sort of like this beautiful model type. She was, the audience could see themselves in this girl's, Brenda Walsh's eyes.
Well,
and have the boy, the heartthrob be all caught up with the heartthrob.
And the reason that I thought I could do it was because I could write a family show.
Yeah.
I knew I could write a family show. You notice, guys, when I leave the show, it's after season 5. The Walshes are gone. It's not even remotely resembling a family show anymore. There's no more parental guidance. Made for interesting stuff.
To the point where there's cocaine and everything else.
Did they take it full advantage of that opportunity to compare itself to a family show? No, they didn't.
No.
So that's my thinking on this date.
Yeah, I mean, this was a great episode of the podcast. We got a lot of insight into
A lot of yapping on my part.
No, I think it's great.
Okay, guys.
Yeah.
Those who are the super fans who followed us all these years. I don't think much of this will come as a surprise.
I just think that there's incredible context here to the fragility of 90210's future. You're talking about a show 30 years later, people going to 90s condo, go see all these people. And the reality of it is they could have been 10 actors or 6 actors that
at the point that we get through and we make some better episodes and people are happy and the Gulf War happens and we're getting scripts. Our orders for scripts were 2 at a time.
Right.
And it wasn't just because they didn't believe in our show, because they didn't have the money to pay for them.
Exactly.
It was just a unique confluence of characters, which, if you think about it, the audacity of the incredible television impresario, Barry Diller, saying, we're going to go old school and we'll put this show back on in the summer when no one else we're going to put ourselves on.
Is it Sandy? Is it Barry? Is it whoever it is?
Barry Diller. It's Barry Diller.
That's
Sandy executed. Darren and Charles executed. And
that's the move.
Yeah.
All right. This has been great, Chuck. The exciting news is that Larry has found more dailies. So
yeah, I heard that.
So we have that we're going to be looking at, and I no longer have to edit a pizza movie, so I'm around to do more episodes of the podcast. So let's pick some things out and dive right. in.
And especially, I think we're going to be doing something, a couple of out of town, we're going to do a yes. feature on some of our fans and who are doing something kind of special here in Los Angeles this week.
Absolutely.
And Pete and I are going to do a real short little segment with them. And is Brian going to come back? Did he add some stuff on Reddit or not too much? I thought he was.
Oh, yes, I'm supposed to do that. So maybe we'll push that to when we do that with the girls.
Yeah, either that or the one with Larry. We can do
yes,
either
okay,
one. Or maybe if there's enough material, we yeah, keep okay. going. But for us, guys, you know we've done almost everything. At least in the Rosen years, we've done just about everything that we could do with the episode. So it has to be stuff. Please don't hesitate to get in touch with Pete.
Yeah, just say, give us ideas.
What like, about this? Cover what this? About that?
And even if it's in the weeds, like if you want to know something about, you know, working at, I mean, the bad example, but if, or maybe not, what was Fox like? You know, if you want something super hyper specific about 90210 in the early years, let us know. More character.
Well, it would be an interesting one, but the actors would probably have to participate in that, which is the Fox publicity department.
Oh, definitely. The marketing, all those promos.
And there's some people around who could comment.
Yeah, okay. All right, that's something. All right, thanks, Chuck.
A lot of fun.
Yeah, I'm about to get ready to watch the Mets game now, and I'm so
we're watching the Mets game now, and then we're going to be on Saturday night. We're going to be in Dodger Stadium watching the Dodgers play the Padres. And by the way, Melanie, who we miss very much doing the Padres, she and her son will most likely be there, just sitting not too far from where we are.
That's exciting. That's very exciting. All right, see you soon, everybody.
Bye bye.